Good morning, universe, and welcome to another day redeemed from death and looking forward to life because of what our Lord Jesus Christ has done for us. You're listening to Sharper Iron, waking you up every morning with the law and gospel of the living God, drawn straight from the text of Holy Scripture for you, all a part of your morning drive for the soul here on Worldwide KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, administrative pastor at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Rockford, Illinois. And on this Friday, June 14th, 2019, we're going to be looking at Genesis chapter 38, verse 1 through 30. Hard left turn. I mean, like out of the blue. Wait, what? Wait, we were Joseph and then, but Potiphar, what? Yeah. Judah and Tamar. You probably, maybe, almost remember this story. Maybe, maybe not. Whole bunch of color here to join us this morning on Sharper Iron with Genesis chapter 38. And to help us through it, we have with us Pastor Sean Danzer. He's pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Great Bend, North Dakota, as well as Peace Lutheran Church in Barney, North Dakota. Pastor Danzer, welcome back to Sharper Iron. And I love your notes for this, by the way. They're wonderfully... Scattered sounds bad. I don't mean bad at all. Scattered is more like all over in an amazingly diverse way. There's so many angles to this thing. And the first thing you wrote down was like a lot of color here, a lot of color. So why don't you just talk about that and what you mean by that? Because I think it'll be a good introduction to where we're going to be going.
Well, thanks for your underhanded comment or compliment.
Oh, yeah.
yeah, brace yourselves, everybody. This is one of those really weird stories in the Bible. This is the one, frankly, that a lot of non-Christians, I think, would trot out and say, you know, you guys don't talk about this in your Sunday school, do you? Proves that you're hypocrites again. Or they might just say, this proves that the Bible is a really horrible book. You got to really, you know, cut out a large chunk of it in order to make it this nice, happy thing that most Christians try to make it. We have a whole mess of sin here. And a whole mess of sin of the grossest, tawdriest kind. And it's going to be important in the end. It's important not just because it's in the Bible, but we're going to see, especially if we have a long view looking to the New Testament too, we're going to see that this is important because all of this mess today stands directly in the line of our Lord Jesus Christ and his birth. So, are you ready to go?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. So just maybe say something about the context, though, in that, and I said the hard left turn, this certainly comes out of the blue in the narrative as Genesis is going, right? I mean, you're not really expecting this turn. You're all geared up to see what happens to Joseph. And now it happened one time that Judah went down, right? It's just kind of out of the blue.
Right.
So what do you think about that? And the placement of that. I mean, I think Moses wrote this, so I think Moses wrote this on purpose. He could have put this at another time. Maybe it's just when it happened, I suppose. But he seems to be as much concerned about when it happened as giving you reasons for understanding things. So just thoughts about that.
Well, we definitely heard all about the brothers, and we heard about their various responses and their various interests in whether we should, save Joseph, whether we should just go ahead and kill him right now. But they present themselves, even in the nicest brother, as pretty rough dudes. And I guess we kind of get to see that here. Rough in the way that they treat the rest of their family too, so to speak. Judah is the one, I don't know if this is skipping ahead too much, but Judah is the one that we have the promise that the scepter's not going to depart from his house until the Lord reigns. So until Christ comes, in other words. And we get to zoom in on him. I think in part Moses is giving us a chance to see that Judah is going to be the key character. But he's going to see that it's going to be a bumpy road. Whereas Joseph is going to have a bumpy road by none of his own fault. And yet he's going to present himself as kind of the pinnacle of Christian perseverance, of steadfastness, faithfulness. We're going to see one story of Joseph in particular, the very next one that somebody else will get to talk about, is kind of a direct contrast to today's story with all of its Sixth Commandment escapades. And we're going to see Joseph holding himself up as a pure, continent man who's going to do the right thing.
I think
it does fit. Go ahead.
Yeah, that right there is an amazing insight. I had never thought of that as a parallel to, excuse me, Joseph and Potiphar's wife, and you play them off each other. That is exactly what's going on. It makes a ton of sense that it's sitting here for that reason. So I interrupted you, though. Please finish the thought.
Nope, that was exactly my point too. So
yeah,
it does have some logic.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And then the emphasis, interestingly though, on this also being the one through whom the chosen seed will come. And so sometimes I've thought, how much of this narrative is Joseph's narrative and how much of this narrative is Judah's narrative? And Reuben's involved too, but we've already kind of seen the downfall of Reuben. In yesterday's text, it was pointed out, I thought this was pretty interesting, that even his attempts to save Joseph could have just been angling to kind of get back in dad's good grace. Like, here's the favored son, so now you can't hate me anymore, kind of thing. And I thought that was interesting. And then Judah is the one that actually sells Joseph. So we're also going to see through the course of this story the redemption of Judah, because he's going to step up by the end of this thing in the story with Benjamin at the end. And I think that's pretty imperative to see. And then also just remembering then that Judah is the one through whom the line comes. I don't think it's too much to skip ahead. I think we have to look back with that reality to really get the most out of this, that it is not necessarily the most faithful man who ends up being a faithful man through whom the seed comes. And so I think that's very helpful. All right. So also, you did mention, and we can probably bring this up again when it happens, but I think it's important to kind of give a hat tip to this, the idea of Levitical, or I think you wrote it down as Leviate. I've never heard it said that way
it's
before.
It's Leverate. L-E-V-I-R-A-T-E. Leverate marriage.
Leverate marriage. So what is that? Where do we learn about that, and why will we need to know about that as we enter into a text that predates it, really, in some ways?
Yeah, so this is the first place in the Bible that it comes up, but it's not the place where it's spelled out for us. Maybe we'll take a little diversion here to Deuteronomy 25, starting at verse 5. Now, this is the second law, the retelling of everything from Moses, part of his big speeches, too, before they enter into the Promised Land without Moses, by the way. And Deuteronomy 25:5 begins here. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son. So, okay, you got brothers, they're married, but one of them dies without having an heir to his part of the family. Then the wife of the dead man will not be married outside the family to a stranger. Rather, her husband's brother will go into her and take her as his wife, perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And I think, in fact, we should understand this both, I mean, exactly as it sounds to us. One, we know what it means, but two, it's like the most perfunctory way to talk about something that is a little more exciting than that. But that is, it's a duty, and it's going to be a very solemn, you know, put on your straight face. This is not about the fun on the way. This is about the purpose. And here's the purpose. The first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. So the point is, this man sires a son with his dead brother's wife, but it's not his son. It's to be regarded as his brother's son and heir, so that the family name and the family line is not blotted out. And we could read more. It goes on to say there's a provision, this might be important to us, that if the man, the living brother, refuses to do that duty for the sake of his deceased brother, he can beg out of it, but he is commanded in Deuteronomy here to be publicly shamed for it, which is very interesting.
I do find that fascinating as well. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know if you want to read it, but the wife who didn't get a child by him is supposed to take off his shoe, take him out to the front, talk about him to everybody in the presence of all the elders, and then he's going to kind of get this family nickname, the house of him who had his sandal pulled off. And boy, I wish I knew what that great, I'm sure it's a really hilarious Hebrew play on words, but I got to confess, I don't quite know what the point is.
Now, what I find, I think, most interesting in that is as I was hearing you read it, I couldn't help but think of how the idea of name and legacy and the son of a man being the future of the family and feminism just don't sit in the same room together at all. And so then there's this way for the man to beg out of it, but the woman can't beg out of it, right? But then there's this like other bit that you just threw in there, which is like, no, the woman wants this.
Absolutely.
Back then, at least, right? And she actually has the right, if he begs out, to call the guy a coward publicly, to mock him, and to give him effectively a name that is not a good name for him and his family. And so how does that mesh? I mean, how far are we from the, what, godly, even natural, normal, like natural law way of understanding woman and man, that we don't see the value in this, even though by no means will I advocate for polygamy or any such thing. There are clear prohibitions against that, but we should still be able to see the value in why this was done at the time that it was done, and we don't. So just kind of respond to that thought too.
I think where our hypocrisy is out there for everybody to see in this, I don't think there's anybody, Christian or otherwise, who doesn't like the phrase or doesn't expect that to be somehow brought into the marriage ceremony. The two become one, right? We're together. We're, you know, putting our lives together. We're pour, think of all the silly ceremonies that we've invented lately, right? We pour our sand in each other's bowls or whatever, right? We become one. And yet I think feminism, or just general rank selfishness, which is everywhere and in every age, teaches us to put an asterisk behind that. No, not quite. I mean, really, I'm still my own person. And the most offensive thing is if I would cease to be my own individual self-fulfilling person. That is the whole point of marriage. And that is the whole point of Christian teaching on marriage, is that the two become one, that they are joined, and not just intimately, but also in their entire life as well. And you can see the wife in this Levitical command, as well as Tamar, the hero or anti-hero, whatever you want to call it, of our story. She has that attitude. This, her husband's honor is not something outside of her that she has to defend because those are the rules. She cares about it. She values it. And in fact, it is because she's married to her husband that she has a place in this whole family, even if her husband's no longer here. She has something to say about Judah. He's a father to her. He's part of her family, his tribe. So she's part of his tribe. And we're going to see Judah is trying to, I mean, he kicked out one guy out of the tribe in the last chapter. He's about to kick Tamar out too, or try.
I like, just to reemphasize, you said that the reason for marriage is to cease being an individual. And you know, we get that out of Genesis. It is not good for man to be alone, right? That's why marriage is created. And so in one sense, feminism isn't even the problem. Feminism is just the dirty fruit that grew from the Enlightenment view of, I think, therefore I am, I'm all alone, each man's an island. The individual is greater than the community. And certainly there are abuses the community has had before that, which denied the value of the individual. We don't want to deny that either. But we maybe had that pendulum swing a little far at this point. And to consider looking back at the value of ceasing to be an individual in terms of everything in the world, and I'm just me and it's me and it's got to be good for me, and see that our real purpose and value in life comes from serving the other, not from serving ourselves. So with that, shifting into chapter 38, get a little bit of this before we go to break here. And we got a lot of text ahead of us. It is. Now, you mentioned tawdry. I like the word tawdry just as a way of describing it. I think it's kind of funny, actually. It's a good story. You know, for all, it's Game of Thrones-esque in like more ways than one, right? Because Game of Thrones is a good story in part because of how bad it is. And you watch these humans who are like, wow, but I get it in a sense. And so this is going to be very, very similar. So I like this story, even though I don't want to say that it's good, right? It is awful. It is an awful story.
We don't blush.
Although the redemption is good.
We don't blush because we've never heard or imagined these things. We blush because we know they're not right, and we know we don't want to promote them. But it's not as if they're foreign ideas to us. That's the purpose of sheltering children, is not that they never see this stuff or you think you could actually keep them from it. It's to shelter them for a time so that when they are able to hear it, they're able to recognize, and also at the same time say, okay, I can see why maybe I don't have to learn from experience not to do it this way.
Right. This is not the kind of thing you want to learn from experience, for sure.
No.
Again, kind of where I was going, final thought. What I love also, though, is that it is a redemption story by the end of the day, and we'll come back to that, I'm sure, by the end. So chapter 38, verse 1 goes like this. It happened at that time. Remember, Joseph just got sold. At that time, it happened that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite whose name was Hirah. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her, and she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Er. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. Yet again she bore a son, and she called his name Shelah. Judah was in Kezib, I think is how that would be, Kezib, when she bore him. So he's off away from the family, which isn't really... Like if you're the patriarch right now, right? You're the lineage. You don't know it yet, I suppose. But this is not the way you're supposed to do it in any way, shape, or form. You're marrying Canaanites, or not even marrying them, but having babies with them and kind of messing around quite a bit. And then he does take the wife. And Judah took a wife for Er, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. So again, the wife isn't even the mother of the child. So the way this is being described here, why don't you just pick all that apart? Because that's all a lot of how that happened. Wait a minute. What kind of stuff?
Oh, I don't know if it's, you're bringing up something I wasn't aware of. I'm not sure it's necessarily insidious. This is the way they talk about it. So I think he's got these wives. I mean, we can ask the question, why is he marrying a Canaanite? But at this time, all of the Israelites are marrying to Canaanites. So that's not too strange at this point in time. I don't know. Mostly it seems like she's a fruitful woman and he has three sons now.
Well, but I guess what I'm saying is that
the point you were going to say.
But what I'm confused by is that maybe Tamar is Shua's daughter, and that's where I'm missing it. I was thinking that Shua was the name of
So remember, don't get confused with Jacob. That's the problem. Jacob, Israel is the big patriarch, Joseph's father and Judah's father. Judah's a man himself now too, grown up man, grown up son of Israel. And he is now having his wife. His wife is Shua, and Judah, Joseph's brother, and his wife, Shua, are now having their children. They've got three of them, Onan, and Shelah. Er's the oldest. He's the one who's going to, in the next verse, marry Tamar.
Right. So I guess what's got me here is that Tamar is not Er's mother, and that it says he takes a wife in Tamar for Er. So it implies to me that he doesn't actually marry Shua or bring her back. He just takes the kid.
A wife. This is fathers get to find the wives for their sons.
Oh, now I got it. We've gone quite a ways then.
Maybe you can ask where Israel is in the picking of Shua, but I'm not sure that's the point here.
I get it now.
Anyway, Judah's going to find his wife for his
I was son. Misreading the take a wife language as like for himself. So yeah, which is silly because I know better. So yes, which means it's been a while. Er has grown up, right? So how much time is passing? Is this all while Joseph's in Egypt? Again, we maybe don't have time to chase all of that today, but you've at least cleared it up for me. Cool. So his wife is Shua. Judah's wife is Shua. And then Tamar is going to marry Er. Got it. Verse 7. But Er, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. Now, we're not told much more about that, but like this is the guy who the seed might come through, right? But I guess not, because not the chosen one. Judah said to Onan.
Works the same in English as it does in Hebrew, too. Is to make a mistake. It's also to be wicked in Hebrew. So, oops.
Oh, really? So that was his name. Yeah. They just called him that after that, right? Yeah, the guy who got killed because he was not
wicked.
Inerrant.
He was erring.
Yeah, he was erring. That's good. That's very good. Thank you. Then verse 8, Judah said to Onan, and you probably know that name from Onan's sin, even if you don't know what that is. Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother. This is this Levirate marriage that we were talking about earlier, right? You have to marry her now and then have kids. They won't be your kids. They'll be your brother's kids. But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, So whenever he went into his brother's wife, he would waste the semen on the ground. And I don't need to explain that. You know what that means. So as not to give off offspring to his brother. So the idea here was not so much about his own pleasure as about not actually fulfilling the duty that he had to bring forth a child. And what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and he, the Lord, put him to death also. Huh, interesting. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up, for he feared that he would die like his brothers. Excuse me. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. Now, I don't know if the referent there that he feared that he would die like his brothers, that probably is a reference to the younger son, Shelah, rather than Judah himself. Judah isn't putting himself in this situation. But somehow he thinks
Tamar's a black widow now, right? Tamar's the black widow.
Yeah,
she's
right.
Killed off two right. husbands already. Not going to get my third son.
So we have a whole bunch of stuff there that is just kind of sitting on the surface. I think we probably have to discuss it, particularly Onan's sin, which becomes the long-term argument against solo sexual actions, right? Trying to just kind of be a little not crass about it. What are we to take from that? I know, I think Luther used it that way as well as in his understanding of it. Although it's been a while since I saw that. I mean, what's this doing here? Is this a morality story or what? What's going on?
You know, there is this one kind of caveat to all of this, and that is this command for the Levirate marriage, which none of us have either in our general customs of American life, nor in the New Testament commands for marriage. So we don't have any force in exactly the same way as Onan did. Onan didn't have a whole lot of choice on this. Oh, although as we looked at Leviticus, if we're going to at least bring that law from Moses' time back into this day, which I'm not sure whether we're able to do that or not. If we were, Onan would have a way to get out of it, although he'd be shamed, right? So I think we have to at least see this, though. If he's not going to do the deed for the point of it, why is he still going ahead and doing the deed at all? This is a way of remember what is the wife's concern in all of this? She cares about this because she wants a child, because it's her name just as well as her deceased husband's name that's going to be preserved. She does not consider this to be this is about the child. The whole point of it's about the child, and Onan gets that. That's why he doesn't want to do it, because he wants it to be his child if he has one. But he still goes and does it. This is a case of where we're trying to pick some middle road between saying yes or no makes you a worse coward and a worse sinner in this case. He's there's no two ways about it. He's abusing her. He's using her for this purpose, for an intimate purpose, for enjoyment purpose, without any of the obvious benefit of it that she is doing it for.
Yeah, I think that's very important to see that his self-driven use of her as a sexual object without being willing to fulfill what in a very narrow way is the purpose of that sex at that time. It does have something to say about our own views of sex today in American society, in which we have so divorced the act from the result that we don't believe they're the same thing. And the culture of hookup, the hookup culture that exists amongst, you know, young people in general, but we teach them how to do it in college and a little bit in high school too. That's why you send them there to some extent. Oh, you don't? Well, you should know that's what's going on. So it's important to be aware of that. We're training them to have this view of sex and to have this kind of action be normalized and the way that the sex is approached. And the issue is more about the objectification of the other human being as a vehicle for pleasure and the fear of fulfilling duty as God designed it than anything else. And that is an issue that our culture, well, continues to reel from, because all the stuff you see that you think is really obviously wrong, well, it's all the sixth commandment, and those things are generally tied together and have connections. Sharp Brown's going to be right back on the other side of this break in the middle of a pretty intense conversation, and we have a big announcement coming up, so you definitely want to stick around.
Bye. Relationships make the difference between knowing someone or just knowing about someone. This week on the Lutheran Hour, our guest speaker, pastor and author Paul Schult, introduces us to a unique and unifying way to understand the Christian faith and message, getting to know Jesus through the language of relationships. This week on the Lutheran Hour.
Sundays at 12:30 and 5 p.m. on Worldwide KFUO.
Concord Matters is a show seeking agreement in Christian confession. I'm Pastor Charles Henriksen, one of the hosts of Concord Matters, heard on Worldwide KFUO each Tuesday at 2 p.m. Central and a repeat on Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. Central. We take an in-depth look at the Book of Concord with some fine Lutheran theologians. Concord Matters, live on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Hi, this is John Bon Jovi, asking you to go to serve.gov to get involved in something you believe in. I'm a big believer in the power of we.
We weren't born.
We can tackle the tough challenges we face and build community through service and volunteering. United we stand, united we serve. Are you with me? Go to serve.gov for more information about how to volunteer in your community.
This message is brought to you by United We Serve and the Corporation for National and Community Service.
This is Pastor Brian Wolfmuller inviting you to join me every Monday afternoon on Cross Defense, 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock here on KFUO Radio, where we take up curious topics, curious Christian topics, to excite our imaginations, equip our minds, and comfort our consciences with the supreme and beautiful clarity of God's Word. It happens on Cross Defense every Monday afternoon, 2 to 3, here on KFUO. Please make plans to join us. And if you can't join us live, check out the podcast at kfuo.org.
Onan Sin, Judah and Tamar, the prostitute who becomes the one through whom the lineage of Christ eventually will come, all in Genesis chapter 38 here on Sharper Iron this morning, here on Worldwide KFUO, where we preach Christ for you anytime, anywhere. Pastor Sean Danzer of Trinity Lutheran Church in Great Bend, North Dakota, and Peace Lutheran Church in Barney, North Dakota, is helping us out with our text. But we have a quick announcement here. Try to keep it as brief as I can. I'll talk about it a little bit more in the coming weeks. When I came to KFUO nearly 3 years ago, there were a number of goals that both KFUO and I had. And one of the major goals I had was to, and it, kind of the charge I had too, was to rethink and look at the way the morning programs worked and to reinvent them for the modern era and to do it with intentional Lutheranism and a hunger to it sounds like you're doing something there, Pastor Dan. You're pouring some coffee.
Oops,
I hope.
Excuse me.
To reinvent it with a goal for the modern era, and then also to keep it as Lutheran as we could get it. And so that has happened. And most of it I ended up letting go of as I then went back into the parish a year ago, and we held on to Sharper Iron. This last year, some more discussions came up, and it was agreed that it probably is time for me to let that one go as well. And I have other things I want to do, and I think the program's in a great place, is kind of just in the right place to hand it off to somebody who can take it to another level altogether, put his own stamp on it. And so we've had that discussion that's been in the works. My last day on Sharp Iron is going to be June 26th of this year. It's just a little under 2 weeks away. And Genesis will almost be over. That's the worst part. Genesis won't quite be over. But stepping in to take my place is going to be someone who you already know, someone who I think you already like. His name is Pastor Timothy Apple. Pastor Apple is a regular guest on Sharper Iron, and you know his voice is very father-focused, very measured, and, of course, very, very capable of wielding the scriptures well to help you understand. And I think in some ways, he's going to be a far better host than I will. So I look forward to seeing what he's going to do with the show, and I hope you do too. I hope you've enjoyed my presence on the show, but don't let my presence be what you think this show is. This show is about two pastors hashing it out over the Holy Scriptures, and that is going to keep going on here on Worldwide KFUO. We'll make this announcement again going forward, but for today, I don't want to take any more time away from this rather significant text here in Genesis chapter 38, where we're talking about what? The purpose of marriage. We're talking about adultery and lust. We're talking about the family of Jesus. Before I read the remainder of the text, Pastor Dan, is there anything else from those verses 1 through 11 that you want to make sure we take a shot at before we move on?
Sure. I think it's worth saying that the sin or the wickedness of Onan is not, there's a Monty Python sketch on this, right? The wasting, that word means to use it to no effect. And, in this, he had a purpose, a very particular purpose to fulfill, and that's the very thing he didn't do. I just think that's kind of a helpful misunderstanding or a way that this text gets mocked as silly and nonsensical when I think it does have its own logic. It's very clear what he's there to do. The way that it comes across in English is exactly the way to understand it. Perform the duty, right? The duty of a brother-in-law. In a sense, your duty is not even to the woman as much as it is to your brother. And he's now shamed and abused both of them. He's abused the memory of his brother by, in a sense, violating his own sister-in-law because he wasn't doing it for the purpose he needed to. And he certainly spurned her by not giving her what was expected.
Right. Also, so contrary. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. Just that we realize also that Sheila, the younger son, is not of age. He's like under 12. So this is a strange idea to us. But it might be worth us actually looking at Ruth chapter 1 to understand that. But if you have anything on that, go for it.
Why don't you just go ahead and hit that? We got a limited time. I want to make sure you get what you want to say.
Sure. I'll just paraphrase it. Ruth 1 verse 11. This is where the ladies, you know, their mother's a widow and their widows, these three widows together. And she makes this lament that, you know, there's no more sons in her womb. They'd be too old anyway by the time they got born, and I can't find a brother-in-law to do it. She's talking about this levirate marriage, this weird idea that the grandma could or the mother of Ruth could find her brother-in-law, be impregnated twice, have two babies, wait for them to grow up, have them be sons, and then marry them off to Ruth and Naomi. And it is all kind of a contrary to fact. Couldn't happen physically, but legally, it's this levirate marriage. And same situation here. Sheila's not old enough, so according to the law, he's supposed to kind of just wait in abeyance and be a man in waiting. Is there such a thing? In this levirate marriage, there is. So.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. All right, cool. I think it's important to reemphasize what you said about Onan's sin, at least as the way it's taught in some circles. It's not just a blanket prohibition against self-pleasure, although I think we can teach against that without this text just fine, generally speaking, but it is about the gift of pleasure being within the marriage for the sake of a particular duty, and that our goal is to believe in and follow that duty. And we don't have the narrow prescription of having children for our sisters and brothers at this point, but we do have the prescription of what Paul says, to treat each other with gentleness, to do our conjugal rites, and to see that as a gift that holds us together, and to receive the blessing of children as the Lord gives. And to that's really all we need if we actually believe that. With that said, could go on to it, as it means a huge topic. But verse 12 continues the story. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. See, now I'm confused again. Judah married?
The Canaanite man was named Shua, and he had a daughter, and that was Judah's. Sorry.
But we don't even get her name. Shua. Do we ever get her name?
Yeah, that's true. No, we don't.
Huh, that's interesting.
Maybe we get it in a genealogy, probably.
Well, because all of these boys really don't matter to the actual line of Judah, right? At the end of the day.
That's true.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So when Judah was comforted, when Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shears. When he was comforted after the grieving period, right? He and his friend Hirah the Adullamite. And when Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep," she took her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up, and sat at the entrance to Anaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Sheila was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage, right? So she's aware.
Pause there a second. Yeah. Go ahead. What you were going
to
say.
Just she's aware that the marriage isn't happening. It's kind of like, oh, they're lying to me here. And then Judah's had his wife die, and he mourns, but then he heads off on a road trip. And on this road trip, it's going to be both business and pleasure, as it were. So Vegas. Mm. Yeah. What were you going to say?
No, just that she catches on that Judah's being a snake here. He's not going to give Sheila. He said, oh, yeah, go to your dad's house and just wait a little while. But that's not actually going to happen.
Yeah, she can see it's
also a little insulting to send her away from her rightful family back to her father's home. That's the kind of thing that happens to divorced wives, shamed wives, barren wives. And she's none of these.
When Judah saw her, again, sitting by the side of the road, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. He turned to her at the roadside and said, which interesting, that, you know, covering the face at that time was not a prescription for anybody in the Middle East as a woman, the way it might be some for some religions today. But if you were covering your face, it would actually be you're hiding your shame, right? You don't want anyone to know what you're doing. You wouldn't take that off during the prostitution act. You're hiding the shame. So that's kind of important. He turned to her at the roadside and said, come, let me come into you. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And that's just fascinating. Like, here, I'm on a trip. I'm the son of Israel through whom God will save the world. Hey, a prostitute. Cool, let's go. Right. Whoa. Hey, dude, slow down. Well, that's what happens, though. Verse 17, middle of verse 16 still. She said, what will you give me that you may come into me? So they're haggling for the cost, right? He answered, I will send you a young goat from the flock. And she said, if you give me a pledge until you send it, right? I want the money up front, which underhand deals often go this way in all manner of places. When you hire a contractor, you want to make sure you don't give him the money until he's done fixing the kitchen. I mean, trust me on that one for sure. And so she says, you know, if you give me a pledge. Verse 18, he said, what pledge shall I give you? She replied, your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand. Which these are like just not random things. These are like marks of his identity in the culture and in the public square. So he gave them to her. Whew, Gus, we got to imagine a little bit. It's like going to a prostitute and you're like, I don't have cash. I'll pay you later. And she goes, well, give me a pledge. And you say, what? She says, your driver's license. And you're like, okay, here you go. Right. Wow. That's bold right there. So he gave them to her and went into her and she conceived by him. Then she arose and went away. And taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood. So, you know, it's over. It gets away, but she's got this driver's license, right? When Judah sent the young goat, he actually follows through on that part. When he sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, to take back the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. Uh-oh. And he asked the men of the place, where is the cult prostitute? Ooh, cult prostitute. This implies that prostitution has already become a part of religion. Interesting. Where is the cult prostitute who is at Anaim at the roadside? And they said, no cult prostitute has been here. So he returned to Judah and said, I have not found her. Also, the men of the place said, no cult prostitute has been here. Right, so they can't find her. Judah replied, let her keep the things as her own or we shall be laughed at. Right? If anybody knows about this, we're in trouble here. Yeah. So you see, I sent this young goat and you did not find her. About 3 months later, Judah was told, Tamar, your daughter-in-law has been immoral. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Well, she's had sex outside of marriage. Moreover, she is pregnant by the immorality. And Judah said, and here's where it gets kind of dark in a sense, right? Bring her out and let her be burned. Whoa. Well, that's interesting. I mean, it technically is kind of trying to make it clear that sexual immorality is wrong. But remember, this is the guy that like just didn't have a problem with it a little while ago. So he says as though it's in the family. He's got to deal with it, I guess. Verse 25, as she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, by the man to whom these belong, I am pregnant. And she said, please identify whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff. Then Judah identified them and said, well, you're getting this, right? That as she's about to be brought out to be burned, she like goes to a place in her tent and says, oh, will you send these to Judah and just say, so he knows, I know who was the one who did this to me, and maybe you want to punish him too. And here, you probably can figure out who it was. And like, it's his driver's license again. Like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah. Verse 26, then Judah identified them and said, this is good. This is the redemption part. She is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son, Shelah. So he doesn't even just say she's more righteous than I in terms of like, the event of the sex, right? But he sees what he has done to her, and that's powerful. And he, again, it says, that's interesting. When the time of her labor came, there were twins in her womb. And when she was in labor, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. But As he drew back his hand, behold, the other brother came out. Wow, quite a delivery. And she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. Therefore, his name was called Perez. Afterward, his brother came out with the scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. Now, that's interesting too at the end of the day, but let's just deal with initially the primary story. Where do you want to go, Pastor Danzer?
It is a great story. I think you see some sharpness on Tamar's part, although I don't know if it's exactly put to a good use. Also, Judah, okay, so I think we need to see him as an honorable man with a wife. And now we need to see him as a guy who becomes dishonorable in his widowership. And the Bible is clear in the New Testament on this also. Once your husband or wife dies, you are not bound to them forever. You're able to be remarried, but you're not free to be what on the market, playing the game, whatever people say. He is being a lewd old man at this point. And what he does is wrong. Now, there is some room for debate on whether this was a recurring event that he would look for prostitutes on his sheep shearing trips. This friend of his does kind of sound like the proverbial lewd friend who is your wingman or whatever while you're doing inappropriate things, because he's the guy who goes to give the payment, right? where's the prostitute and all that? I don't know. But in any case, it is strange that he doesn't recognize her for her voice or for her figure or anything. I think it just shows when you're focused on something else, you don't pay attention to all these little details. Maybe also another objectification moment. He doesn't even recognize the voice. Tamar now has been treated as just an object in a couple different ways over and over again in this story, which is a real shame. Anyway, she's not interested in the sex either. She puts on her veil of widowhood after this. Again, she's the one who does it exactly the opposite way of Onan for the purpose of this child, as needs to be done. And the upgrade to a cult prostitute, unsure what that means. If he's trying to say, well, maybe Judah wasn't such a bad guy. He was only an idolater, not a lecher. But in any case, you kind of wonder whether the people in this town were in on the deal or not, if they're kind of covering for Tamar. Well, I don't know what you're talking about. We don't have any prostitutes here. It's kind of an insult on our town. Why don't you get out of here already? But they don't want to be laughed at. Go ahead.
No, please continue.
I do really like that you brought up the redemption story, if you're ready to go there.
Yeah, go for it.
It's not the best confession of sin, I suppose, but it kind of says it all in one. She's the one who's more righteous than I. That isn't to say what Tamar did was right per se. It really wasn't. But her intentions were clear and limited. His were simply for his own pleasure. And the real sin that is brought out, that Judah brings out here, and he's doing all this, by the way, in his place as head of the family, as judge, jury, president, all of it, legislator, all of it. He's the one in charge of the whole community. And he says, I did the wrong thing by not actually following through with this Levirate marriage and my third son. That's what was supposed to happen.
And the result of this then is fairly important in that Perez and Perez more for some reason. Perez and Zerah. Perez is the one of the line, right? He's the one who will be the one through whom Jesus will come. Yeah, I think that's right. So what you have then is, right, is Judah has a son named Er, who then at this point has a son named Perez, even though he had never really had it, even though the son came from Judah's seed. But that's sort of the way that the lineage at that time would work. I am curious now, does Er doesn't show up in the lineage of Christ, though? I think he's out. That's really interesting to me, because I think so much of this is really about, the whole narrative is really about the line of Christ and how the history of God's promise in Genesis 3 is just working its way through all of our various forms of tawdry idiocy, right? And so I think that's a big piece to look at there. The bit about the cult prostitution, was that the other thought? I don't remember. There was something else you said that I thought was really worth repeating, but I can't remember.
Well, you brought up the point, you were asking the question, it's already associated with religion. I always think just this is one of the most obvious things to confuse with God is sex. It's another way of hedonism, right? Pleasure is confused with God. But it certainly is the way the ancient world worked, that the guys would go and do their true religious duty with ladies that lived and worked around the temple. And the fee would, I guess the church becomes the pimp. Again,
right.
Not advocating this at all. This is evil. But it does... I think it's fascinating that this Adulamite says this. I don't know if he's trying to make Judah look better because he's only an idolater. It wasn't a weird sexual thing. Or whether Judah thought it was a cult prostitute. Was he actually engaging in idolatry as well as inappropriateness, breaking the sixth commandment? It does kind of pile up the various sins. And it's worth maybe just, we don't have to say much more than this, but incest, which is what we have going on here, is an especially heinous sexual sin throughout the Bible. And it remains that way, at least in our country right now. And I expect it to continue. So,
yeah, I would expect incest to remain something that is a taboo for us. But I don't think we're so far away from cult prostitution, honestly. It may be a little while still, but that is a very normal thing in the pagan world throughout history. Many, many cultures get there. And given the way that we do treat sex today and the way we're despising religion today, I would not be surprised to see in my lifetime, I'm 40, 41 now, in my lifetime that we have such a thing being present in our streets. And as Christians, we just got to be ready for this, right? Our sons need to be ready for this kind of thing, even as they need to be ready now for the version of it, which maybe doesn't have God's name tied to it. But by all means, I mean, the reason you go to college is the movie Animal House, right? I mean, that's like Pretty as Me by a good stretch. And it's worse. It's worse today. So to be aware of that, to see that also Tamar in this is righteous in her desire for a child for the line. And that's an amazing thing behind all of this. We're down to just a couple of minutes left here. Yeah, please go.
Tamar's a Canaanite. She is not a full-blooded Jew. She's a Gentile, which I think is also important for thinking of Christ, that his lineage includes not only sinners, but the sinners he came to forgive, but also Gentiles, the people he came to die for and save. Tamar's this outsider, right? She's got nothing except she's got this law and she's got the value of the promise that she has married into, right? And that's her way back in. And she's being treated like, go back to your dad's house, forget about it here at the end. Well, you're the prostitute. You're this horrible person, right? She's been trying to be. They have done everything they can to kick her out of the line of Judah and the house of Israel this whole time. And she's been steadfast, at least in this one thing, that she knows as an outsider that the only way she has in is this law of levirate marriage. And look, I think we have to think as Christians, she's in Christ's line, the knowledge of the promise of the seed, which she in some ways connected to. And that's why the levirate marriage law exists, for the sake of continuing the lines and ultimately looking to Jesus. So that's the thing that in all of this wickedness, which is by no means to be imitated or excused, that is the thing that is slightly more righteous than Judah, is that she has on her concern, both her place in the community and her and her husband's lineage to continue.
So we got about a solid 2 minutes left here. Anything else in your notes that we didn't get to? I mentioned how good they were, and I know we didn't touch all of them. So what, want to throw one more out there?
I'll try and do just very briefly with this comparison to Joseph leading into tomorrow's text. We know the story of Potiphar, or at least for the movie or the play. She chases after him and he, is unwilling to do that. That's kind of, I guess you still have the lady chasing the man. But in this case, Joseph does the right thing. He says, no, you belong to somebody else. I'm not going to engage in it. And he remains chaste. He gets punished for it. I suppose it's the opposite of Tamar, right? And Judah, they do the false deed and they aren't punished for it. And yet Joseph is not in the line of Christ, strange as that may be. So what should we take away from this as Christians? For sure, think just of the genealogy now, the fact that this tawdry and sordid story is in the line of Jesus Christ. Well, it shows us already in his lineage what his purpose is. He's come to rescue sinners. declare righteous those who in no sense of the word are. He's come to forgive us. So this is not an example, but this is a great comfort, I think, to us to see that Christ did not turn away from people who had made horrible choices, bad mistakes, and done evil things, but he forgives them and absolves them. We can have comfort then in our sins, not to continue in them, but to receive the comfort of his forgiveness. And then just another reminder for most of my listeners, I'm imagining, are not full-blooded Jews. So you have been included even from the Old Testament in God's plan of salvation. He's always been coming for the praise of the Gentiles, as Paul elaborates in his letters. And Tamar's one of those Gentiles who was absolved and is part of Christ's line. And so she should hold a special, if weird, place in our heart for that reason.
I love it. It means that all Jews are Gentiles, because all children of Judah are from Tamar, ultimately, right? So that's kind of a cool thing. Pastor Sean Danzer is pastor at, at Trinity Lutheran Church in Great Bend, North Dakota, and Peace Lutheran Church in Barney, North Dakota, helping us out today with chapter 38 of Genesis, Judah and Tamar, the lineage of Christ, redemption and grace, and how it all means that you are baptized, saved in him. He's risen. He's coming again. This is Sharper Iron on Worldwide KFUO. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, and I look forward to waking up with you at that dawn.